2000 AD Thrillcast Supplemental Number 1, Emma Beebe. Borag Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Now, we've got something a little different for you this week. Obviously, last edition, we broadened things out and started talking about 2000 AD in general, not just the 2000 AD association with Hachette and the Judge Dredd Mega Collection. But I also wanted to be able to bring you something a little bit more in-depth. So the supplemental episodes are intended to be an opportunity to talk to an artist or writer or to focus on a particular character or story in a bit more depth, give a little bit more time than we normally have in a usual edition, just so that you can get a better idea of the kind of talent and ideas and work that goes on behind the scenes at 2000 AD. So for the very first one, and with the second episode, which will be going out next week, we are going to be talking to one of the newer writers that has started recently on 2000 AD, and that's Emma Beebe. Now, Emma started work 2000 AD with writing partner Gordon Rennie, but has also gone on to write both Judge Dredd and now Judge Anderson as a solo writer. Landmark stories, because for the first time those two characters have been written by a female writer. So over the next two episodes, we're going to talk to Emma in depth and hopefully glean some interesting facts behind her writing style and the kind of thing that she enjoys about writing for 2000 AD and beyond. Now, joining us on the phone all the way from Scotland is the woman herself, Emma Beebe. Welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast Supplemental, Emma.
Hello, thank you.
So the idea of these supplementals is that we get to talk to you in a little bit more depth about you as a writer and your work for 2000 AD and also beyond. The reason why I thought you'd make the perfect subject for the first Thrillcast supplemental is that you've got a new Judge Anderson story in the current edition of the Judge Dredd magazine. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the story?
It's obviously the first time I've written Anderson. Not many people get to write Anderson. Mm-hmm. So it's it's something of a privilege to get to write her. The story takes place, I think continuity-wise, it's basically after Dead End. So she's headed out of the city and she's off into the UT townships. And there's a cadet, a side cadet called Flowers, mm-hmm. who has had a strange vision of creatures attacking one of the townships, and a couple of judges just standing there and letting it happen, and it's all very strange and he doesn't know what's going on. So they, so Anderson has been deployed with him to go and investigate. That's basically the setting. So it's just a two-parter, but yeah, it's been very exciting for me.
Now, there's a bit of continuity in there in terms of the setting. Was this a story that just came to you, or was it something that you wanted to explore, having read some of the aftermath of Day of Chaos and the mutant storylines?
A little bit of something that came to me, but initially, I pitched a slightly different story, but also with the with Cadet Flowers in it. Mm-hmm. But it would have been something of a longer, more ambitious story. and Matt suggested I do something shorter to introduce him first. So I got a two-part slot and an opportunity to do something in the townships with the muties. So. This was the story that kind of came out of that, but a lot of it maintained some of the things I wanted to do in my original story, which I may yet come to. So yes, it kind of came out of that. I'd not really done anything much with muties before, so that again was you know, that was an exciting thing to take on, a bit of a challenge as to how that was going to work, particularly when you're in the townships and there's basically just muties and their relationships with the judges, and you know, thought it was going to be a bit different from doing a story set in the city.
For those who are listening who don't necessarily know the backstory, the Mutie Townships are the result of Dredd's failed attempt to overturn the genetic purity laws of Megacity One. Are we going to see as part of the story some of the fallout from that, or is it just the setting that you're interested in playing with?
There's definitely a resentment among and a plot, I would say, among those who are, you know, basically in charge of and leading the muties on this particular thing that they're doing. So there's definitely that's what sparked it, and I think also I didn't kind of explore in a really obvious way, but the back to that is, you know, obviously chaos day came and things are obviously very different now, and I think the perception is that obviously the city's in something of a weakened position and the judges are in a weakened position, and this has created something of an opportunity. So there's that kind of background to it as well. So there's the resentment, and then there's the weakness of Megacity One as perceived by this township. So anyway, I don't think I'm giving too much away.
Well, I should really warn people, there may be spoilers during the course of this episode.
Possibly.
it's interesting that you're playing around with the ideas of that, and you said it in the Mutie Townships, because of course Dredd's world is not static. It changes and it evolves, and it's interesting to that Anderson has not been immune from this, because there was a story a little while ago where Dredd and Anderson were out in the Cursed Earth dealing with the rather awful burial pits from Day of Chaos, which had a major effect on Anderson's psyche, and now she's back out there as a character in this story. Anderson, who is now a woman in her 50s, recently, and again spoilers, attempted suicide in a previous story. How do you approach such a complicated character when coming to it for the first time?
Well, I think she's wanted to get away. She's putting on something of, you know, a bit of a brave face and getting on with the job. And I think because she's got this cadet with her, she's kind of got a duty of care towards him as well. But the relationship between them, I think, is quite interesting, because he gets a sense of what's been going on with her, but obviously, you know, she's definitely the senior person in their relationship, and it's not like he can really talk about it with her. But I think it's definitely there, and it's referred to in the story, and she obviously isn't enjoying being out there. But at the same time, I think I wanted to kind of show being, I don't know, she's taking risks, but she is taking calculated risks, and I think she wants something she can conquer and do by herself with this young cadet. So there's all those kind of psychological factors that I was trying to at least hint at, but I didn't want to get too much into her head, so much as to show how she was acting in that situation. So that was kind of my approach. But I mean, she's a great character, and one of the things I do love about that world is how it does change over time, and these things happen and people age, and you know, most of the city dies overnight, and you know, all these things they take place, and they radically change the universe and the kind of stories that you tell, and the characters develop over time. And I think it's I think it's interesting and kind of amazing that there's this, you know, this character who's female, who's in her 50s, who has her own strip. Mm. And I'm trying to think of anywhere else that that would happen, and I can't think of anywhere. So she's pretty unique in comics in that way. And she's got a lot of depth to her, and, you know, those are things that attract me to writing her as a character.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that is most striking about this story is not just that this is the first time that Judge Anderson has been written by somebody other than Alan Grant and John Wagner, but you're also the first woman to actually write the character.
Yep.
As many of our readers have said, about time too, which, you know, absolutely. I don't want to go down the kind of hokey cliched route of as a woman, you know, how do you write a female character? But I think it's far more interesting that as a character that has been so utterly defined by really one writer, which is Alan Grant. That's that's an awful lot of backstory and pressure. And how did you deal with that?
How did I deal with that? I guess it was more about thinking about where she is now, because I think you can get too bogged down with worrying about all of the backstory and things you should refer to and all of this stuff, and in the end, it can get in the way of the story you're trying to tell. And I think with a character who's changing over time in the way a person changes over time, the most important thing is to think about where they are at that moment and try and be true to what Alan was saying out in terms of her psyche. So I've tried very hard to keep to that. So yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but I think If you sat and, you know, reread all of the Anderson stories and thought really hard about it, and I think it would actually become so intimidating that it would be impossible to do it. And I don't want to have so many references and things that you know, I don't want to be trying to prove that I know Anderson, you know, just as well as Alan Grant, and I, you know every line of Shambhala or whatever. I don't need to do that. What I need is to show that I understand the character where she is just now. And try and portray that faithfully.
Is she a character that you've followed previously, or are you relatively new to her?
I'm relatively new to most of the maybe compared to most people who've been writing it. I guess that's, you know, I don't know if that's a typical female journey in comics, but I didn't really start reading comics until I was about 17, 18. And then I kind of stopped for a while, and then I came back to it. And I was thinking, it's funny, I think although I'd read individual 2080s because I knew people who gave them to me and said, this is great, you should read it.
Yeah.
I think the first one that I was given that I read from beginning to end was actually Judgment on Gotham.
Oh, wow, okay, yep.
Which was a sort of slightly weird place to start. I'm thinking, what on earth is all this about? So, trying to come into something which has been going for a long time was a bit daunting. But I've made strenuous efforts to you know, read the key stories and keep up with things. In terms of Anderson, I think the first story I read of him, I honestly don't know. I just remember it was the last part and she was kicking doors in and, you know, kicking butt and doing amazing things, and she was pretty much by herself in that story. And I was really struck by her and thought, you know, this is great. For me she really stood out, maybe because I was a female reader, and most of these stories are very, very masculine and male dominated, so for me she stood out, and plus she was quite a contrast to Dredd, complete opposite of drag, really, in so many ways. You know, she's relatable, and you know, she has reactions to things like normal people in some ways, but she keeps, you know, she keeps doing her job and things affect her, but she keeps coming back to it. She goes away, but she comes back, and she deals with it. And I think that, yeah, that all made her very interesting. And, you know, quite early on, I thought she would be a great character to write, but I don't know if I really thought it would happen. I thought, you know, one day I'll pluck up the courage and I'll ask Matt, please.
let's talk about that. How did you come to be writing for 2000 AD?
I'm just really cheeky.
that's often the best way to be.
I just asked. I didn't want to kind of. I didn't want to plan out anything too much first, because I thought if I get really attached to a story and he says, "Are you joking?" then I'll cry. So I just asked, you know, would you be interested in seeing something for Anderson? And there was this long pause, you know. and I thought, God. But eventually came back and said, okay, let's see what you've got.
Right,
so, okay. So yeah, it was a case of kind of prove yourself a bit, but that's good, you know. I wouldn't have wanted it any other way, challenge.
But you, I mean, it's not as if you didn't have form as a writer previously, because you've done lots of stuff before. Let's talk about a bit about your career before 2000 AD. What kind of things were you writing before?
Well, my first job as a paid writer was writing horoscopes. I've always done writing. I've done various strange kinds of writing. Yeah. I wrote, you know, political speeches and and horoscopes and you know, lots of different things. I worked in politics for a long time, so those were my first experiences of writing. I always ended up being a person who wrote things. So no matter where I was, I ended up writing things. It all seemed a little bit, maybe I should be writing. I ended up doing it anyway. So I decided I wanted to do, what I wanted to do. It wasn't all that long ago. I mean, the thing that, you know, I'd sort of been working on a few things and thinking, ugh, this will never happen. I have no idea what I'm doing. And then I saw, what was it that I saw? Alien versus Predator 2. And that was literally the most disappointing film I've ever seen in my life. And I was quite excited about it. I know that's really sad, but I was quite excited thinking, you know, this is going to be this cool alien predator hybrid thing. It's going to be amazing. And it was so awful. And I thought, oh my God, what am I doing? I can totally do better than that. so that kind of spurred me on.
Right.
I took about 3 weeks off, and I went to Greece, and I just worked and wrote. And, you know, I had lots of ideas and things I wanted to work on. And from there, I went to film festivals and hung out with directors and got work. And some of it was fun, and some of it was a nightmare, and some of it didn't happen, and sometimes I didn't get paid. And I thought, maybe screenwriting's a bit rubbish. So at that point, I was quite keen to do other things as well. And it was after a few years of doing that. And it's really strange. I met Gordon Rennie, and I met Yishan Lee, who's an artist, a manga artist, on the same night in Edinburgh. And it was Yishan who said to me, "What are you doing? Why aren't you writing comics?" And it was so weird, because it had never occurred to me at all. I mean, I was reading comics as a script writer, and I never thought about writing comics. And that was just, felt so stupid. So it was good to kind of have that moment of realization. And in fact, it was Yishan who Gordon and I together, and she said, "I want to do this story. Mm. I want you two to write it." And we were like, "What? we barely know each other. What's going on? Why are you telling us we have to work together?" She's a very forceful personality. She kind of just goes along with what she says. So we ended up sitting down and talking about work that we'd been doing, and we had this surprising moment of realizing that quite a few stories we were doing were really similar.
Right.
And I mean, mine were better, but but that was quite strange. So I don't think we really thought we were going to find areas of commonality until we actually sat down and we exchanged a lot of scripts. And from that, you know, the writing relationship grew. So we did this thing with Yishan, and then we worked on Doctor Who audio and comics and things. So, you know, it kind of fell into place at that point, and various things started working out quite well, you know. All of a sudden I felt like I was doing the things that I actually really enjoyed, and it wasn't as much of a struggle as trying to get anything done in screenwriting. Screenwriting kids don't do it. yeah, it kind of all came from there. I guess that's the short version.
I like that you mentioned writing horoscopes, because we interviewed Alan on the Thrillcast a few weeks ago, and
oh, right.
he started off his career editing and writing romance stories. For those old style sort of 1970s romance magazines that just had all these made up stories, and he used to completely rewrite Amazing. Them because they were awful. So everyone's got to start somewhere. So you know, horoscopes,
you
romance.
I had so much fun writing horoscopes. I can't even begin to tell you. And that was another job I got by being really cheeky.
Right.
And I think I'd actually had quite a few gin and tonics, and I emailed these people, and my dad was really into horoscopes when I was young, so right. I actually knew about these things, and I wrote some really cocky emails saying that I knew about semi-sextants and all sorts. I have no idea. And then I kept getting these phone calls at 8 o'clock in the morning, saying, you know, you have to come for an interview for that job you applied for. And I was like, what job did I apply for? And then I went to Glasgow. They just got me to go to Glasgow to go to an interview to be an astrologer. And I just couldn't stop laughing. I was going up on the lift and I was just killing myself laughing going to this interview. I couldn't keep a straight face. I can't believe I'm being interviewed to be an astrologer. what happened? There were for teletext and text messages. And so you know, this was like in 2000 or something.
Right.
So that kind of 140 characters that actually came from teletext. Apparently,
right.
That was their length for short things. So I was doing that, and I would, you know, 140 characters isn't really very much to be creative in terms of voice. And so basically, I would decide on a couple of star signs to pick on.
Yeah.
And it was usually Capricorns and Cancers and Scorpios for some reason. I don't know why.
Right.
and they would just have a really rubbish week, according to me. Or I would base them on songs I was listening to. And I did a whole series, because I would turn them in like a month in advance or something.
Yeah.
And then I did a whole series based on Kate Bush albums. Sounds like, today you'll feel like you're running up that hill.
Oh dear, I'm snorting. Brilliant.
I wonder if people who take these seriously, maybe I'm influencing their lives. I start to feel a little bit bad. But sadly, the job went, and they didn't do them anymore.
Oh, no, that's brilliant. I think that's the perfect grounding for writing about futuristic fascist cops who can read minds.
It's a little hilarious. Anyway, that was fun. I think I was introduced to the possible fun that could be had in writing, and you can kind of entertain yourself, and nobody really notices.
Yeah.
So all of these things remain possible anyway.
Brilliant.
Horoscope.
Yes. Well, you mentioned the Doctor Who audio that you worked on with Gordon Rennie. Did you find the experience of doing audio dramas beneficial to comics? Because obviously you're pretty much dealing with almost all dialogue there.
Yeah, it's very different.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, because there's no, you know, in comics, you know, provided, you know, the patience of your artist, you can do really exciting visuals, and you can write one sentence and then they have to draw something enormous and amazing and visually spectacular, and you can get a lot across on the page visually. But in audio, it's everything has to be described by the characters experiencing it, which can be quite a challenge, because you don't want it to turn clunky, you want it to sound naturalistic, and it's really hard. and also when the scene changes, you have to establish who's in the scene and where they are every single time the scene changes. Every, you know, 2 minutes you have to put a reminder as to where people are and what they're looking at.
Right.
So yeah, it's great discipline, because it really makes you pretty tough on yourself as to what is acceptable as dialogue, and trying to make sure you don't have anything too extraneous in there, not just random things people are saying, because you need to describe something, so keeping the conflict up within situations in between characters while revealing information. I mean, there's also lots of fun things you can you can do with that. There was a scene in the first one we did where the Doctor is talking to some merchant at a stall, and you know, this person's trying to sell him something. You're not really very sure what it is he's trying to sell him, because you can't see it.
Yeah.
And in the end, it turns out to be some ridiculous hat full of feathers and things.
Right.
So you know, you can kind of keep your listeners guessing. So there are fun things you can do with the medium, but it's a very different way of thinking. I think when I write comics, I quite often find myself leaving panels without dialogue, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe I should put dialogue in. I don't really know, and I quite like sticking to visual things. I think that my instincts are more about getting things across with the visual, so doing something which can only allude to the visual. yeah, that teaches you a few things, but it's a nice difference. I think it really helps you as a writer to work in different mediums, that you can get too into the conventions of one medium versus another, and anything that gives you more practice makes you stronger as a writer.
Sure. Okay. Now, we've already alluded to your work on Judge Dredd, and I'd quite like to kind of talk about that in a bit more depth, because you wrote a story with Gordon called Suicide Watch, which was set in the aftermath of the Day of Chaos. Now, for those who are listening who haven't read Day of Chaos, I really recommend you go and pick the collected editions up, available both in print and digitally. It's one of the harshest, most hard-hitting mega epics of all time in Judge Dredd's world, and saw pretty much most of the city completely wiped out by a series of biological terrorist attacks and sort of physical attacks on the institution of the judges and things. So the city is very much in ruins, and John Wagner, who wrote it, was very adamant that this would change the status quo. Now, I've read interviews with Gordon and yourself, in which you've talked about your reaction to that changed status quo. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how you both reacted to the aftermath of the Day of Chaos?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it is quite shocking. I think, you know, I mean, at the time, yeah, that was my first foray into the world of Dread as a writer. Mm. And so it was from talking to Gordon about it, and he'd been, I think all of the creators on it were sent something out from 2008 saying, by the way, things are going to change just a little bit. And I think there was this huge ripple shock that went through everybody, thinking, my goodness, you know, how is this going to affect the stories that I've been thinking about doing? And how do you write, you know, how do you write a funny story in the aftermath of that? How do you do your standard, just, you know, hunting down your criminal kind of story? All of these, I mean, it changes everything so much. The scar on the city and the population and the psyche, you know, everybody is absolutely massive. And surely that would change the kind of criminal activity, the pressures on the Justice Department, the, you know, the way your ordinary citizens are handling it, availability of food, they, you know, the fact that everyone you know is dead, all of this stuff, you know, it's got absolutely massive implications for the story world that you can then legitimately create. And, yeah, Gordon and I talked about this, you know, over a few drinks. And by the end of that, we thought, you know, probably the most obvious, likely outcome is that people aren't going to want to live in it. They're just not going to want to live in this world. They're going to, you know, they're going to frankly be pretty miserable and suicidal. And we thought suicide cults were an obvious thing that might result in the aftermath of that. And that was something we wanted to show. So, yeah, so I mean, for me, I didn't really have any particular Judge Dredd writing ambitions at that point.
Right.
You know, I read it and everything, but, you know, I think when you know, as a writer, when you look at a character and things occur to you, you think, yeah, I want to write this, or, oh, this thing could happen to them. And I just kind of didn't get that with Dredd. But once that happened, suddenly for me it absolutely changed, and I started having ideas for things that could happen in that world, whereas I think for everyone else it was possibly like, oh my goodness, what am I going to write now? so for us, we thought, well, we've thought of this now, I guess we should pitch it. so it kind of grew out of that. And we also wanted to put in this Sai Judge Hamada, who Gordon had written before, and we thought she might be particularly feeling the effects of what's been going on. So, yeah, putting her into that world where, frankly, she's having trouble even wanting to work, to do anything, and is feeling suicidal herself. And hunting down a suicide cult.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was where that came from.
I think the story works because it does have Hamada in it, and as a telepath, in the face of all that death. I mean, it's something that coincidentally Alan had explored in Judge Anderson recently, of when you are so sensitive, when you are able to feel the emotions of those around you, the death of, you know, 350 million people, it'd be a daily struggle just to keep going.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that was, you know, that was something else we wanted to look at, was how, you know, if you're a telepath, it's not just seeing something in someone's head. It's probably feeling that as well, and it would have an impact on you as much as it does on the person who's experiencing it. So if you can look around and everyone, you know, everyone's horror and darkest thoughts and experiences are open up to you wherever you go, even the residual in a building just passing by and feeling what happened there and seeing what happened there, then it makes it very hard to hide. I mean, how do you protect yourself from that? You can't. So yeah, it was a little bit about, you know, it's not just about seeing cool things in someone else's mind and using it to work out who done it. Yeah. It's also got a very personal impact on those who have those abilities.
Because with Day of Chaos, obviously, this is something, the aftermath has been explored in different ways. But the element of the exploration of it from a kind of psychic, from an emotional point of view, I think has only really been dealt with significantly with the Apocalypse War. There was a story after that where Dredd and Anderson were on patrol in one of the nuked sectors and found a couple, and before the nuke had hit, he'd been in hospital on a life support machine, and she had been watching over him, and the nuke had hit, but the machine had kept him alive, obviously killing everybody else, and so there was a ghostly essence of her still watching over him, and that's the only time I can think of. I mean, you know, to our listeners, you know, do correct me if I'm wrong, if there's other stories out there that deal with this, but it's interesting that had not been really explored before in any great depth, though of course it's had an impact on Anderson in the past. But bringing this up to something a bit more cheery, you recently did an interview with Women Write About Comics regarding your work on Judge Dredd and Anderson. And there's a great quote in there which says, "I'm drawn to things that are more comedic, slightly taking the piss." It's something that a lot of people who've been away from Judge Dredd for some time sort of mention, which is that back in the 1980s there was a lot more comedy, there was a lot more overt satire, a lot more ridiculousness. Is this something that about Dredd that appeals to you, about the ridiculousness of him and his world?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I'm trying to think of an example, but like the story, I don't get the name right, it's Slow Crime Game. And it's so funny. I mean, it's just a one-off, one episode classic Wagner, and it's just that wonderful kind of comedy satire, that, you know, the world of Dredd, you know, you can go a lot of ways on it, and that's one of the reasons why I think it's lasted so very long. Is the huge potential of things that you can do, but it's so ridiculous in so many ways that you can do funny stories within that world. And I don't think, you know, to those in the world, they won't think they're funny. but to us, I think there's that massive potential. It's so, it's such an extreme world, and Dredd is the most extreme of the extreme. And just, I think, how, you know, there's stories about how far does that go for Dredd? You know, does he, you know, what does he do on his days off? Does he have days off? Yeah. What does he do? How does that work? What is he if he's not hunting criminals on his bike? What's that about? You know, so it's hard to imagine him as anything else. You know, it's entertaining to imagine him as anything else. Maybe not hard, not the right word, but it's trying to see where someone that extreme stops. So, and the fact that you never see him with his helmet off is just genius, because, you know, there's, you know, where does that stop? Yeah. Does he sleep in it? Does he shower in it? What does he do? So, you know, there's all these... To me, he's obviously this massively intimidating figure, but he's also kind of funny. Yeah. So the things that that I want to do with him are usually funny. That's what I see. Maybe that's a reaction to the stories I did before that were so depressing. I mean, I did one for the summer special where, you know, these terrible things keep happening to him, accident after accident, yeah, disaster after disaster. And, you know, he's dread. It's still just, you know, whatever. He just takes it in his stride and, you know, he's so blasé about it. But it's just the ridiculousness of his reactions to the stupidity of the world, yeah, are really funny. So that's kind of what I find entertaining, yeah, and just the extremities.
It's the fact that no matter what the world throws at him, he always plays it completely straight.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, he doesn't crack a smile, he doesn't tell a joke, he's the job, yeah. And you know, it's interesting to write him because he's such a commanding character when you get in his head. You know, I had this experience of writing him and think, you know, I plotted out the story and thought, right, and after this happens, I'm going to go and do this. And we got to that point in the page and Brad was like, no. Nope, that's not what I'm doing. I'm going off to do this instead. You're like, okay, you're the boss. So that's what he's like, right? He's in charge, and his reactions to things are have a kind of purity to them because they're so instant. He doesn't doubt himself. He doesn't ponder. He just does things, and I think that's quite hard, well, at least for me, to deal with in the abstract. Until you get into that situation, his reactions aren't necessarily what you think they're going to be. But yeah, he's a strange one to write, and I was quite intimidated at the prospect of getting into his head. But it was fun. it was a lot more fun than I was expecting. He just takes it. He takes it all on, and that's kind of a nice feeling. He goes with it. So yeah, I mean, I like all the different variety of stories. They don't, you know, they don't have a sameness to them, and that creates a very, very rich story world. So yeah, it's a treat.
And we've already touched on this, but you are the first woman to write Judge Dredd for 2000 AD. Did you realise this before pitching to Matt, our editor?
No, no, not at all. I mean, you just kind of think, well, at that point it'd been 35 years, and you know, at that point you don't really think about how many people have written it before you. Even there's probably one in there somewhere. It wasn't really something I thought about, and then it wasn't until it was close to coming out, and it was sort of, I think you or Matt or somebody was checking, and we were like, can you check this for us? Because we're not pretty sure. Someone said that we're the first woman to say that, can't be right. And yeah, it's a shock. It's definitely a bit of a shock to be the first on something which has been running for, well, as long as I've been alive. So, that seems like a long time to not have any.
Yeah, it's one of those things where Dredd has been so dominated by a very small number of writers. So it's kind of not like your normal superhero comics in America, where there's a constant churn of new titles and new talent coming through. So actually,
yeah,
you know, the opportunities for new writers who've earned either their spurs or, you know, have written elsewhere and, mm-hmm. And come in is relatively limited. What was the reaction to the story from your point of view? How did people react to your first solo story on Dread?
My first solo story.
Yeah.
Can't remember. I think it was. Well, that's probably a good thing, isn't it? I think there was an awful lot of reaction the first time. You know, the one that I did with Gordon.
Mm.
There was a lot of, you know, media interest, and I got a lot of tedious questions about what do you think you bring differently to it as a woman?
Mm.
And it's just kind of, I don't know. Well, I haven't checked. I'm not asking my ovaries. I mean, it's just. I just thought it was ridiculous, because if you think about those questions, it's like, you know, your self-awareness in being of a particular gender only goes so far. So for me, I'm, you know, if I take on a character with a 35-year history, my concerns aren't how do I make this a womanly story. My concerns are how do I make this an authentic Dread story.
Yeah.
How do I make sure I bring across all the things that you have to bring across in this character? How do I get the world right? That enormous, terrifying world full of millions of things. this enormous backstory, which I didn't grow up reading and have been catching up on. You know, all of those things are much, much more intimidating than you being a girl. yeah, it's all quite ridiculous. I mean, it is important. I'm not going to deny that it's important. You know, it's good that it's happened, and I think it helps to see it happen. It helps that there's visibility of it happening. I mean, as I say, when I first thought about writing comics, it wasn't an idea that came to me. It was an idea suggested to me by another woman in the industry. Because it never occurred to me, I guess, because I didn't know any, you know, female writers who did comics. I, you know, it's not something where you see people talk about comics and there's loads of women. There's not. So you kind of, if you're not aware of them, they're not maybe as obvious. And I think, you know, I remember going to a comic convention quite early on. And I was on some ridiculous panel, and I was thinking, God, these stories, some of them haven't even come out yet. And here I am, the only woman on this panel with, like, Mark Miller and Alan Grant and Gordon Rennie. And they're going to be like, who's that person at the end? Who's the girl? Who's she? So that was pretty intimidating to talk about comics at that point, when to me, I've been doing them for ages, but to the audience, they were like, who are you? But at the end of it, I remember people came up to me, and they were majority young women.
Right.
And I didn't see them, you know, the cues for talking to Mark Miller were 90% guys. And it was these young women who came up to me and went, you know, I've never really thought about it before, but I'd quite like to write comics.
Mm.
And I think if you can see it, you know, it does help. I think it is important from that perspective, and that if you don't have a visibility of women in an industry, then I think it's harder for women to see themselves in that industry. So from that point of view, I was very glad that it happened. But it's not what I want to be known for. Certainly not the only thing I want to be known for.
Sure.
I mean, it creates an awareness of my work, and people then go and read it, then that's super. I mean, the scary thing for me, I suppose, when that all happened, was just thinking, you know, if they hate it, if they hate everything I've written, then it's going to be like, oh my gosh, no more girls, that's it, shut the doors.
Mm.
And the reaction from readers might be more negative because of this expectation of, you know, somehow you're going to swoop in and do something more amazing than anyone who's ever come before because you're different.
Yeah.
So And yeah, I mean, all of those fears were completely unfounded, and I've been really lucky. I've had nothing but good experiences. I've had nothing but a warm welcome and positive feedback and people saying, you know, we're looking forward to you doing the next thing. And I mean, I was worried because it's, you know, a publication with a long history. It's got a very strong, long-standing fan base. And the fact that I was welcomed was very reassuring.
So that's all we've got time for on this week's Thrillcast. I want to thank Emma Beebe for joining us to talk a bit more in depth about her work, and we'll be talking to her a bit more next week about her work for 2000 AD and beyond. Thanks very much, Emma.
Yeah, thanks. Looking forward to it.
So thanks again to Emma for joining us on the 2000 AD Thrillcast Supplemental. Hope you enjoyed the slightly more in-depth talk that we've had this week with Emma. Next week, more of the same, talking to her about her work in 2000 AD, but also beyond into other franchises. So please do join us next week for another supplemental episode for the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. That's all for this week. Splundig ver thrig, Earthlets.